Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is the current head of the United States Preventative Services Task Force, Dr. Ned Kalange. We'll be discussing the purpose and function of the task force, as well as the task force's recent and perhaps controversial breast cancer screening guidelines, and as usual, we'll address your questions and comments. To ask questions or to make comments, you can reach us in Anchorage at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and you can email us at line1@kska.org. Dr. Kalange, welcome to Line One.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We kind of got on the air in a hurry. I didn't get a chance to discuss the fact that you're not only the head of the United States Preventative Services Task Force, but you're also a state epidemiologist in Colorado and the chief medical officer. Is that correct?
That's right. I work most of my day job is public health in Colorado.
I was going to say, how do you have time for this job if you've got another day job that's as interesting and as demanding as that?
Well, I'll tell you, it takes a lot of help and a little bit of understanding by my boss, the governor.
Well, let me start by saying something I was going to talk to you about before we even got on the air. I came up here with the Center for Disease Control as an epidemiologist, and I think I understand the confusion and problems with the recent guidelines, and they seem straightforward and understandable and correct to me. And what I'd like to try to do today is help people understand where things might have gotten confused and why they are appropriate. Is that okay with you?
That sounds great.
Let's start with the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research. What's that? How does that involve you? And then what's the task force and it's all about? What it's all about?
Sure. So let me start with the task force. The task force has been around since 1985, and despite what people might have heard, it's an independent group of volunteers. So none of us are employees of the federal government, and we're not really paid for this job. We donate our time, volunteer our time, in order to have this commitment to prevention, to come together and really set the bar for recommendations that are based on the best available science around preventive services. The Agency for Health Research and Quality, which we affectionately call ARC, is a government agency that actually hosts us. So the people who pay for our airfare into Rockville, Maryland, which, you know, might not be your first vacation spot, although it's very nice, set up the meetings, give us meeting space, provide staff support. They are all federal employees, but no one from the government gets to discuss or vote on our recommendations. So it's really an independent group of experts from across the country who have expertise in prevention, research methods, evidence-based medicine, behavioral health. You know, we have pediatricians, obstetricians, family doctors, and behavioralists, as well as advanced practice nurses. And we really try to have this objective, cold, hard look at the evidence in making recommendations.
And the overall purpose of the task force is to develop guidelines with which practitioners can feel fairly assured there's evidence base behind that.
Yeah, I mean, what I tell most doctors, if they implement our A and B recommendations, they can pretty well be guaranteed that the health of their patient population will be improved. So it's really primary care clinicians that are our major audience, and we're trying to have our recommendations help guide them through the best approach to prevention for their own patients.
Where does the information, I'm not specifically addressing the recent breast cancer recommendations, but where does the information come from that your body, the task force, looks at, and do they take recommendations from other bodies to consider where they're going to how they're going to make their recommendations?
Now, we really start with the core evidence, the published peer-reviewed evidence of at the very heart of all the recommendations. So what we're looking for is someone who did a high-quality research study, whose results from the study are going to be reliable and unbiased, and we capture all that information through computerized search programs that look through the literature from different countries as well as the U.S. and try to find every scrap of good evidence that supports or doesn't support the use of a different process. So that's where we start, and we really do that independent of the recommendations of others. We tend to point out what other groups recommend so that clinicians reading the recommendation statement know what maybe the American Cancer Society or the American College of Cardiology might recommend. But our recommendations all come directly from a very structured review of the available published evidence.
Does somebody collate that information for you or peruse the vast amount of literature out there to make to come up with the pertinent information with which to look at?
Sure. So the task force members work closely with a group called an evidence-based practice center. So there are a number of these centers that are funded through grant funds across the United States, and they're a collection of scientists who are actually now have extensive expertise in doing exactly what we talk about, designing questions or a framework under which to look at a subject, and we put input into that, and then using computer-aided search strategies to really glean every research project that might be relevant. And then the use of well-trained scientists to sift through the different articles and grade the evidence and say, you know, this is a good study, or this study is too biased to be used, or this study isn't really relevant. And so the evidence-based practice centers, with our direction, input, and course correction, really perform that search and that synthesis with us.
And you mentioned there's a variety of individuals on the task force. What's the total number of members at this time?
It's 16.
Okay.
Half women and half male.
Okay.
And that's an important distinction because I always like to point out that all women, each of the eight women, all voted in favor of the new male breast cancer screening. So this wasn't a bunch of old old white guys making the decision.
Right. There's been some, we haven't even gotten to the guidelines, and we can begin to appreciate the possible politics and the way people look at these results before we even get to the facts. But there's been some concern written. I've seen that there was no radiologist or specialist in that, and I'm trying to assuage that concern as well, since you brought up the male-female issue.
Sure. Well, so the way the task force looks at it is we don't want advocates on the group, because the problem with specialists is that they really aren't unimpassioned reviewers of the evidence. Because they're experts, they filter it into their own practice, their own experience, and their own biases. And, you know, we use a really rigid conflict of interest approach, that if it looks like you won't be objective in the discussion, you don't get to participate. So that's right. We don't have a radiologist on the group, nor do I think that would work. I mean, a radiologist mm-hmm. would likely have to recuse him or herself as not being able to look at the issues objectively. Mm-hmm. However, we do gain access to specialists through our partner review. And so, for example, the breast cancer screening guideline was looked at two board-certified radiologists at FDA, whose job it is to actually approve and look at new technologies. And we got criticism for not having an oncologist, but the actual director of the National Cancer Institute is one of our liaisons, and he's an oncologist. He reviewed the recommendation. So we have that input available to us. We also tend to reach out to expert groups. We did send the recommendation to the American Cancer Society, for example, a known advocacy group, to review and give us comments back. So I think what we try to do is don't let advocacy interrupt the science, but make sure we get the input from the people who are experts in the area.
Bias is really an important issue, and it's amazing to me how well done these guidelines are. Has this effort and how and control and purpose and methodology evolved over the 40 some much years y'all have been doing this, or was it designed pretty much this well from the get go?
I'll have to say that the more we learn, I like to think the better we are.
Okay.
So the standardization of the evidence review by the evidence-based practice centers, that's relatively new, from the late 1990s. So everyone does it this about the same way, and in fact, that approach is used internationally to do the same thing. Similarly, we try to keep our methods up to date, so is that as the research base has gotten richer, we've tried to become more transparent and consistent. So, I mean, one of the issues is we want to treat prostate cancer, for example, screening the same as we would treat screening for heart disease, that the method is applied consistently regardless of the topic. And so our methods have evolved. Our last change was in 2004. Where I'm thinking we're more tweaking than anything else. We did change the language around the C recommendation, which is one of the things that was controversial about breast cancer. And we did that because we talked directly to our target audience, family practice doctors and nurse practitioners, and they didn't like the current wording of the C, which was, well, it's a small benefit, so we can't say to do it or not do it. And that really had us change what we call our templated language to this thing that says recommend against routine.
Mm-hmm.
And what that phrase is supposed to capture is, hey, you're going to have to apply your own best clinical judgment. It shouldn't be automatic. So the A and B recommendations, just do them. You're going to help your patients. The C recommendations, take into account the patient in front of you. And if you believe it's the right thing to do or your patient believes it's the right thing to do, you should give them the service. But that got translated into a phrase that I'm just concerned isn't as clear as we hope, that against routine. Mm-hmm. And I think what we were after was this requires a discussion.
A little bit more before we get to the specific breast cancer. What is the hope of the task force and this organization of how these guidelines will be implemented and used in practice?
Well, what I tell doctors is there's lots of things you can do. There's lots of new tests, innovative tests, cutting-edge tests. And I always joke and say none of those are synonymous with effective tests. I try to teach primary care clinicians to incorporate the A's and B's into their daily practice because I can guarantee they will help the health of their patients. So when I come to a state, I usually pull the mortality statistics, and usually, and Alaska is no exception, half of all deaths in any state are due to conditions that would be improved with the A and B recommendations. And so I say, boy, you know, if you're not doing these, you're leaving life years on the table. You're actually not preventing or as much disease or promoting as much health as you could. So I really say, figure out a way to do these for all of your patients. And for C's, try to figure out a way to do them for the right patients. And for D's, you should try to figure out a way to not do them because they're not going to translate to improvements in health.
Help us understand A, B, C, and D, and then I, which you also have. What those net letters stand for or imply?
So we use this concept called certainty. If we're really certain, it means we don't think we're wrong. We think our risk of being wrong is really low. The other concept we use is net benefit. So the test should have benefit, but all tests, regardless of what they are, have the potential to do harm. Because remember, screening, for example, takes place in otherwise well asymptomatic persons. And that's what we all want to be. We want to be asymptomatic. So whenever we do a test or a medical intervention in someone who's asymptomatic, we want to make certain we're going to do more good than harm. So that's this concept of net benefit.
Mm-hmm.
An A is given when we are very certain that the net benefit is substantial. If you do this, you're going to save a lot of lives. Example of A recommendations are tobacco cessation counseling and hypertension screening and colonoscopy or colorectal cancer screening for a certain age group. These are ones where we just know that this is the right thing to do and there'll be a big benefit. The B's are, we're either a little less certain or the magnitude of net benefit is a little less. So either the evidence isn't as good or the efficacy, the benefits aren't as strong. And the balance, it just adds a little level of uncertainty. But still, we're confident enough to get off the dime and recommend them. The C is when the benefits and the harms are closely matched, but we believe there is net benefit. So it means the test works, provides benefits, but the benefits overall are small compared to the harms. And that's a good place for kind of individualized care. We give a D when we're certain, at least moderately certain, that there's no benefit, or in fact, doing the test is more harmful than beneficial. And so that's a D. And then the I's are this category that nobody likes. It's the I don't know category. It means that there just isn't enough research that comes to a clear answer that we can recommend for or against a service. And the only thing we can say is, we don't know.
Remind our listeners just briefly, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Ned Kalange. He's the current head of the United States Preventative Services Task Force. We've just gone through the formation and activities and a well-structured organization looking very, very critically and as unbiased as they can at lots of information, and they come out with recommendations on screening tests and for various age groups, which seem to be most appropriate and are graded, as we've just understood. If you've got comments or questions, you can reach us at 550-8433 till just before 3 o'clock today. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@kska.org. And let me remind regular listeners, we're going to start repeating now at 7 p.m., not 8 p.m., so tonight at 7 p.m. if you want to have someone listen to the program as a recorded rebroadcast. And remember, you can always go to Line 1 on the internet and at kska.org and listen at any time. Dr. Kalange, let's talk about the guidelines for breast cancer specifically. Now, do you want to kind of summarize those recommendations and then how each was graded? Would that be appropriate?
Sure. And what I might try to do is work backwards from less controversial to more.
Okay.
Let me start with clarifying what we said about breast self-examination. There have actually been two separate, very large, very good studies looking at clinicians teaching women to examine their own breasts. And the results were the same in both of these large studies, that there was no improvement in mortality. And in fact, all they could find was an increase in biopsies that were not cancer. And given our methods, we weren't really able to ignore two studies. So the recommendation is a D for primary care clinicians teaching breast self-examination. It in no way says that a woman shouldn't be aware of her body, and certainly if a woman feels a lump or has other symptomatic breast concerns, that's an important thing to bring to her source of care. Because we know a lot of breast cancer is diagnosed through things a woman feels. What the recommendation says is that as physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, we aren't adding any value by spending time teaching how to do that. So that was the breast self-exam. We have an insufficient rating for a number of things. One is digital mammography, which is a new process, and also the clinical breast exam done with a mammogram. And again, these are insufficient evidence. It doesn't say don't do it. It just says we can't locate the research that shows you get an important health benefit from adding those. You know, there is some research that shows if you can't do mammography, doing a clinical breast exam does reduce some mortality. But since we're really trying to promote mammography use, we just looked at whether or not it adds to that service. Then we moved into recommending biennial or every other year screening versus annual screening. So this is a little bit more controversial. The original task force recommendation, the recommendation out of 2002 said every 1 or 2 years. So we were already looking at the fact that the research showed pretty good benefit from every other year screening. And in fact, at the very core of it, the mortality rates were a little bit better with every other year. But there's no way to actually tease that out. So we turned to a modeling network funded by the National Institutes of Health, and what they were able to do was demonstrate that about 90% of the benefit with all mammography can be achieved with every other year screening. So that's most of the benefit, and that you get that other 10% or so, but at a significant cost in increasing the number of mammograms, and increasing the number of false positives, additional images, and biopsies. So, you know, if you take 1,000 women at age 40 and you screen them every other year instead of every year, the every year may get you one additional life saved. And the cost is double the number of additional studies, the number of mammograms, and the number of biopsies for a falsely positive mammogram. So in looking at the harms versus the benefits, we said biennial is the most appropriate interval. And we looked at that for age 50 to 74. That's where the evidence was the best. That's where we knew we'd be saving lives. At 75 and above, there's just no data. And so we gave that an insufficient. So the way I tell clinicians is that, you know, look at your patient who's 75. It's likely that the benefit doesn't magically disappear. If you believe that she's likely to live long enough to enjoy the benefits of mortality reduction associated with mammography, that's a good woman to screen. So we can't make a recommendation for or against, but we can expect clinicians to be, you know, clinicians and make a good decision. Finally, we looked at women 40 to 49. And our conclusion, based on the number needed to screen to save one life, which is about 1,900, and the additional harms, which is half of all women in that age group will require additional screening, additional studies, and significant number of them will require biopsies that are going to be for false positives. We weighed all of the harms and benefits and said this is a small benefit overall. It basically is it's the worst screening performance of any service we recommend at this one screen 1900 to save one life. There's no test that we recommend that's worse than that in terms of being effective. It doesn't say it's not effective. It just says that effectiveness is small. That 15% benefit really means that if I have 5 women who are going to die from breast cancer without screening, and I give them all mammography, one of those 5 will not die, and the other 4 will, even though they had screening. So that's the benefit. So we translate that into this kind of small benefit. And then we looked at the harms. We said a lot of harms, although they're minor, just a small net benefit overall, that gets a C recommendation. And then I will tell you, we made, I think, our mistake, for which I apologize I'm on record apologizing to Congress, to most of the groups we talked to, and to patients. We didn't communicate what we really wanted to say. We used that templated language that says, we recommend against routine screening. And no one could get past that word against. Okay. And so, you know, what I'd like women to know, I'd like your listeners to know, is we've changed it. We had a second sentence that no one ever got to because they saw that word against and they got angry. The second sentence says, the decision to start regular biennial screening mammography before the age of 50 years should be an individual one, mm-hmm. and take in patient context into account, including the patient's values regarding specific benefits and harms. So what we mean to say is, if you discuss it with a woman, she says, the harms don't sound very bad to me. I want to be screened. You should screen her. If, on the other hand, she says, looks like my chance for benefit is small, and I don't like the harms, and I'm going to choose to wait a couple years or 5 years or 10 years, we also should support that, unless we know a woman's at high risk or there's some other reason to really push it. So that's what we really meant to say, and that got completely lost in translation.
Realistically, it was said, as you said, but people didn't look. I mean, it's very well clearly stated if you read your website that a C recommendation encourages individualized decision making on this,
right.
on anything with a C. So, all right. Let me take a short break. We often or always take a short break at this point, Dr. Kalonji. And what I want to do when we come back is talk about those risks a little bit more, and the accuracy of diagnosis, including even biopsy accuracy, to help people understand some of the complexities of being accurate in these diagnostic processes. Remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. You can reach us at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is lineone, lineone, at kska.org. And after this break, we'll continue to talk with Dr. Neil Kalonji of the United States Preventive Services Task Force on Line 1, Your Health Connection. Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with the current head of the United States Preventative Services Task Force, Dr. Neil Kalonji. And if you've got questions or comments, you can reach us by email at line1@kska.org. Our direct phone number, 550-8433. Our outside number, which is toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you would like to listen again, our repeat tonight is at 7 o'clock. And I'd strongly urge those listening who may have friends, relatives, or yourself who would like to listen again to this very, very important detailed evaluation and analysis of the current recommendations that are being given by the Task Force for Breast Cancer Screening in Women. As you know, we will be here till just before 3 o'clock, and then the tape rebroadcast tonight at 7. We will not be able to take any questions. I've often mentioned on the program that it's very important when thinking about any treatment to look at risks versus benefits. And certainly if there's no evidence of benefit, then I'm not sure you really need to go on very often to look at risk, except maybe in some experimental studies. You've outlined pretty well some of the what we know about benefits. I'm not sure all the risks have been fleshed out in some of the things I've read about, and would like to talk more about risks, even though they may not be very great. What do we know about some of the risks associated with breast cancer screening?
Well, I'll start with the ones that I think you need to be mentioned to be complete. But I think people appropriately try to think about saving a life versus disease. One is the fact that this does involve radiation in and of itself. I wouldn't want your listeners to think that this is a major reason to not be screened. The radiation dose associated with mammography, even regular mammography between the ages of 40 and 49 is really quite small. Our friends, the radiologists, have worked hard to minimize that radiation exposure, and I think that needs to be acknowledged. On the other hand, I think it's important to recognize that there is no really safe dose of additional radiation. That's what the Institute of Medicine concluded about 5 years ago. And most of the radiation that people in the United States get is from medical studies. So while I want to make sure that everyone puts it in proper perspective, we're learning more about it now. It does look like the earlier that you're exposed to radiation, the more harm it may cause, and the more radiation you get. It's kind of cumulative over a lifetime. But again, I think that needs to be put on the back burner in thinking about a breast cancer screening, because when the test becomes extremely effective in women 50 and above, this shouldn't even enter their minds. And one could argue that below 50, it's still a pretty minimal increased risk. We know that there's some discomfort associated with it. This is a man saying this, so you have to put it in context. There's discomfort associated with the test itself, but most women do not find that to be a deterrent. Although I want to tell your listeners that we've seen this thing called mammography fatigue, where someone who starts at 40 and gets a mammogram every year gets around age 60 and says, they've always been positive, I don't like the test, maybe I can just stop. And the problem is breast cancer risk goes up the older you are, and 60 is the age where the test really starts to be good in terms of saving lives. I mean, really good. So I think women should not be dissuaded by negative mammograms or getting tired at a time just when the test comes into its own. There is some anxiety associated with false positive mammograms. Any of us clinicians who have had to talk to women about positive tests can relate to that. It's a difficult discussion, and it's hard to do reassurance during that time. And that breast cancer-specific anxiety has been shown in multiple studies. So I think it's at least important to recognize. There's an unfortunate harm called overdiagnosis, and we learned about this in prostate cancer, where actually most prostate cancer will grow slow, will never metastasize, and had we not picked it up by screening, the man would never know he had it before he died of another cause. It's clear that some breast cancer is overdiagnosis as well, somewhere between 1 and 30%. I know that's a wide range. I think there have been some people who feel it's around 1 out of 10 diagnosed invasive breast cancers. And we treat those because we can't figure out which ones are overdiagnosis and which ones we need to treat. But I think it's important to recognize that that treatment is totally unnecessary. And doesn't make a woman live longer. And I think women should at least know that there's that chance. The harms, though, that I think we're most concerned about are these false positives. And false positive means the mammogram is abnormal, but you really don't have cancer. And we have to do things to get to the no cancer conclusion. In women 40 to 49 who start screening at 40, half of them will at least require a callback for additional images or some additional intervention. Most of the time, it's an ultrasound or some other views, some other mammographic views. But that's a pretty large percentage, and it's higher for the women 40 to 49 than any other age group. And then ultimately, a number of those women will go on to require a biopsy for a false positive. And so you need the biopsy, but you don't really need it. So the only reason you need it is because you had the test. The test was positive, but it was wrong. And you need the biopsy to prove that the test was wrong. And so those are the harms that I think women really should at least be aware of in making the decision to be screened. And those harms are highest in the 40 to 49-year-old age group.
Okay. Dr. Klunz, we have a caller, and I want to take her call before we continue along this line.
Sure.
Bonnie, you're on line one.
Hi. I have a question regarding insurance. It seems like if the CDC puts out an A or B, that you could have a test or a treatment, and insurance is probably going to pay for it. But if you get a C, and even though you said it's kind of an individual case-to-case situation, I can just see insurance saying, we're not paying, and then the woman's going to have to pay out of pocket. What do you find about that?
So I think this is a critical point. I hope that folks will understand, if you actually read our methods, the task force does not and has never looked at cost in our recommendations. So while a lot of the criticism we got was this was a cost-saving measure, this recommendation was voted a full year before anyone was talking healthcare reform and coverage reform, and costs never entered our decision. However, I think the caller, Bonnie, brings up a very good point. We never intended the recommendation to translate to a coverage decision. In essence, that's not part of our, I know this is going to sound not forward thinking, but that's not our charge. Our charge is to develop an evidence-based guideline free from issues about how much it's going to cost, coverage decisions, or how people are going to implement it. And so what she brings up is important because she's right. A lot of insurers translate the A and B into coverage and the C's, D's, and I's into not. What healthcare reform allows for is for Congress to make a decision independent of the evidence and independent of the task force to cover these services where they think it might be important. And in fact, the healthcare reform bill, the Affordability and Accountability Act, actually includes an amendment that says mammography will be covered for all women down to age 40. So Congress has already said this is a scientific recommendation that they believe should not translate into a coverage decision. And I would tell you the task force members to a person agree that when we say individual decision making, we never intended for out-of-pocket cost to be one of the things a woman would have to consider. So I think it's a good point. I want to point out that Congress has the ability and has thought about this in moving forward, has actually done it for breast cancer screening. And I think what it does is it allows the task force to continue to stick to the rigid methods that we use and let advocacy and politics occur somewhere down the line.
Well, that's good. You know, I'm glad you're not influenced by it. But for those of us that are trying to pay our bills, I guess all we can say is that was never your intention and tell the insurance company they should pay for it because my doctor agreed this is what I need to have done.
Well, right. And so, again, I hope you find some solace in the fact that at least for mammography, it's covered. And so, and regardless of what else you've heard, as we've looked around, no state has dropped coverage for mammography, and insurers realize that that probably wouldn't be in their best interest. It's such an emotional issue that everyone will adhere to the issue that mammography, at least down to age 40, will be a covered benefit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you for your call, Bonnie. Let's stay with this idea just for a second, even though that's not the purpose of the task force. But when you look at healthcare cost acceleration in almost certainly in our country, let me leave it at that. As my understanding, the number one reason is new technology, new things that are being done and implemented, and some of those are being done without much evidence of cost effectiveness and so forth. They get done, and so at some point, it seems reasonable that we must put some kind of controlling mechanism on that force. Is that true? As somebody, just a physician, I'm not asking you as a task force member necessarily.
Sure. Well, I think you've come on to a very important issue. The United States could pay for everything. I will tell you that rapidly we would move from 15% to 60% of the gross national product being paid for healthcare to 50%, because there really is no end to what we can do. There is, though, diminishing returns in terms of health value, and there are a lot of new technologies we can point to where when we actually study them, they provide no benefit. And yet, because of direct-to-patient advertising, the fact that the market allows you to kind of help market direct to patients and say, if you want this, we'll provide it to you at cost, that kind of fuels the technology going forward. And I'm just concerned that we can't compete in the global economy or even in our own national economy if 50% of every dollar generated goes into healthcare and healthcare services that provide marginal health value. So I agree. Somehow we're going to have the discipline to pick between what works and provides high value and what's only promising and really needs more research. And I think healthcare reform is trying to start that. I will tell you experientially that perhaps breast cancer isn't the place to start. There is so much emotion and investment in terms of avoiding breast cancer mortality that I don't think we as a country are ready to look at this as an area to ratchet down on health services. And again, I think I can't find fault in that. I have a sister with breast cancer. I lost my mother-in-law. I will point out that there's only one other country, though, in the world that screens starting at age 40 every year. And all of the other industrial programs, nations, start usually at 50 with every other year. They were ready for that discussion, and I'm just telling you from my experience since November of last year, it's not clear to me that we're ready for that.
Let me get back to this risk-benefit ratio, and a question I really don't know the answer to, but have, as a 60-year-old male, begun to look at prostate screening much more critically. Let's talk about the accuracy of something as cold as a biopsy and what happens with that biopsy, who looks at that, how easy it is for the pathologist to say, this is a cancer, this is not a cancer. What if they're wrong? What factors drive them to make that decision besides their objective look at it? This is not as clear-cut as people might think. It is my supposition.
Well, and I think that's correct. I think once you move into the positive test world, everything changes. And I think our concern and our aggressiveness in calling cancer kind of goes up. A lot of these biopsies are very small amounts of tissue. Now, we hope to be getting better at those. We actually direct them with radiology, and we try to make sure we get representative tissue. But you can have an error because you didn't get the right thing, and you can have an error because you didn't get enough, and you can get an error because the pathologist didn't recognize that one thing that would have told him or her this is a cancer. You ask about other things. I think the concern about litigation does put the edge on calling more things cancer than less. So we rarely get in trouble with medical malpractice when we say, I thought there was cancer, and then it was treated, and we didn't find any cancer. Where you get into a lot of trouble is when you said, there's no cancer, and then ultimately there was. So I think that kind of litigation pressure helps things look more abnormal. And I think that's human nature.
Okay. An opportunity to quickly look at some of your slides, and one slide that caught my attention I'd like to ask you about is this idea of things that can happen when we have screening tests in general, of which mammography is one. You said five things can happen, four of them are not good. And my intent here is not to keep hammering at the problems with this whole process, but to make it clear that this is difficult and has taken a lot of thought to get to where we are, and then make sure we end on a positive note about all the benefits from this, but make it clear what the recommendations are. But your point in this is that screening tests bring some problems with them.
Yeah, one of the things that I hope people capture from this discussion, which I think has been rich since November, is we don't do a very good job of talking about the harms of screening. In the United States, the lower 48, the upper one, and then whatever that island is out there, we look at cancer differently than the rest of the world. It's, we had the war on cancer, and it's really something that's captured our culture. And this idea about early detection that we as physicians have really generated. A patient comes in and the phrase, if only we would have caught it sooner, is a very common phrase, even though catching it sooner might have made no difference. And so we've sold this idea of early detection makes better outcomes. So what I hope everyone understands is everything a doctor does, or a nurse practitioner, or a physician's assistant, a healthcare worker, everything carries both a potential benefit but a potential harm, and nothing is risk-free. So if I get a screening test, I got to recognize there are four potential bad things. One is that it's falsely negative. And we know that 40 to 49-year-old women, if you screen 1,000 of them with a single mammogram, you will miss one breast cancer on average. That's a false negative. And the problem with the false negatives is now I have given you a test that could be reassuring. So let's say I have my mammogram, it's normal, and in the shower I feel a bump, and I say, well, I had a normal mammogram, so I'm not going to worry about this. Not going to have that lump evaluated is a harm. So that's one of the harms. The second harm is, I always call it the Achilles heel of the screening test. It's the false positive. So the test says you have something, but you really don't. And then you start getting additional tests, diagnostic tests. You have the anxiety and worry about, do I really have this? And we actually have examples of people getting treated on the basis of a falsely positive test. And I would say anytime we do something that you don't really need, that's a harm. The third area is this overdiagnosis we talked about. So as a 60-year-old man, you have a fixed chance of having prostate cancer. However, the chances that you're going to die of prostate cancer are only a little over 4%. And so, up to 50% of men age 60 could have some microscopic prostate cancer. That means almost all of it won't harm you. And the problem with these biopsies is they can't always tell us, do you have the kind we can watch, or do you have the kind we have to take out now? And so if I took a prostate gland out for a prostate that would have never been picked up. A man would have died from another cause without ever knowing it was there. I purport that that is absolute harm. That's treatment that the person didn't need. And if it's surgery or radiation or hormonal therapy, all of those degrade the quality of life. And then the last harm is it just doesn't work. And we have a hard time with this, but there is evidence that many screening tests don't add life years to us. They have no proven or no visible health benefit. And I would suggest that getting something that just doesn't work is a harm. It increases the cost of care, which then decreases access to care for those of us who are still trying to scrape by.
We've got about 7 minutes left, and there's another aspect of cancer that perhaps is useful for the public to understand, and that's that all cancers don't act the same. Some breast cancer might be very, very aggressive. Some might not be so aggressive. And one comment that seems to put this in perspective, although it addresses prostate cancer, I'd like to read, and it comes from Elizabeth Whelan, a doctor who works for the American Council for Science and Health. And I'd like maybe your comments on this, Dr. Collange. She says, imagine that you're a farmer with three different types of animals, birds, turtles, and rabbits, and you're trying to keep them in your property. In other words, prevent cancer metastasis by building a screen. The turtles don't need to be screened because they aren't going anywhere anyway. The birds represent the cancer that's already metastasized. They've flown away with or without the screen. So there's no point in trying to screen them. That would be the real rapid-growing cancers. And then screening then only helps for the rabbits, the ones that are able to leave the property. Unfortunately, with today's screening procedures, we can't distinguish the life-threatening prostate cancers, that's the one she was dealing with, that is the rabbits, from the less aggressive ones, the turtles.
Well, it ends up, this is great, because it gets into all of the aspects of screening. Remember, the mortality reduction for mammography in women 40 to 49 is 15%. So that means if I take five women with breast cancer, four of them are the birds, that even though I screen them, I'm not going to change their outcome. And unfortunately, I mean, the cold, hard science says that those women are going to not have their lives extended even though we screened them. So there's evidence that we have the birds and breast cancer. The fact that we know that there's overdiagnosis, breast cancer that doesn't need to be treated, means that we also have the turtles, the slow-growing ones where, you know, it's fascinating. It's almost ironic that if I'm a woman who has one of those overdiagnosed cancers, one of the turtle cancers, I will believe that the mammogram saved my life, when the truth is I had treatment I didn't need. And then, of course, the rabbits are what we're after. We can get in there. We can screen. Early detection makes a difference. We make the person live longer. And you're right. At this point, we aren't sophisticated enough to tell which cancer is which. And I hope as the radiology and biopsy, seromarker approaches and even genetics gets a little bit better, we'll be able to better counsel women what they have and who should be screened and who it's not going to help. I think, you know, given the time frame, you're right. I think one of the things that got lost in the recommendation is that we do recommend, good screening, reminder systems, everything we can do to assure that women age 50 to at least 74 get regularly screened, because we're going to save lives by doing that.
Yeah, I look at the recommendations. If you read them again, they're very succinct. There's very good science to back them up. The biases, the emotions get in, and people don't stop and think about what the recommendations are. And really nowhere have you said that it's not important for individuals with their own unique situations to be able to discuss those options of risks and benefits with their physicians. In fact, you've now maybe made that very specific, as particularly on that age 40 to 50.
Yes.
We're coming down. Actually, we've got 3 minutes or so. Just any final comments, any issues that you'd like to comment on that I haven't addressed for you here?
You know, one of the things that, that's become remarkable to me over, this is my, I think my 8th year on the task force, and I will rotate off because we like to have new leadership, fresh blood, and new eyes looking at each issue. What's become remarkable to me is that when the task force started, all the clinicians wanted was just tell me whether I should do it or not do it. I want a simple yes or no. And, you know, we don't do that with any other medical therapy. All other medicine is I look at the patient in front of me. I look at their history. I look at their medications. I look at the other conditions they have. I look at their family. I look at their job. And I take what I know and I make the best decision that's based on everything I know about that patient and on the science behind it. So it's complex. It's difficult. And the problem is prevention is the same way. It is not simple. There are very few things other than, boy, never smoke. There are very few things where it's simple and not complex. And I think breast cancer screening, prostate cancer screening, colorectal cancer screening, heart disease, all of these point out that the more we know, the more complex the recommendation becomes. And so as clinicians, we need to work with our patients to help express how complex that is and tailor it to that patient. And as patients, we need to participate in our own healthcare to make sure that the decisions that are made have the best chance of helping us.
All right. I have to say it's been enjoyable. I really think you guys are doing a great job. I didn't know how good a job you were until I started researching the program and then listening to you describe how you do the work you do every day. And as I said at the beginning of the show, I don't know how you have time for this other job, which seems like a full-time job by itself.
Well, thank you. I appreciate talking with you.
Thanks for the good work and keep it up, please.
Thanks.
All right. My thanks to Dr. Neil Kalonge. He is the head of the current head of the United States Preventative Services Task Force. He's the one, the task force that presented the most recent breast cancer screening guidelines. You could go to the website, which lists these guidelines and how the task force works if you want more information from a link on our website at kska.org/line1. We'll return next week, and we'll be discussing where we are now on healthcare reform with Dr. Uwe Reinhardt. Dr. Reinhardt is a health economist, and he's professor of political economy at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Health and International Affairs at Princeton University. Next week, we will not be here. We're going to be taking a week off, and instead, there'll be a backstory, the history of public education, which explores the way Americans' expectations of schools have changed over the course of our history. And it turns out anxiety about the quality of America's schools goes back longer than you might think. Pat Yack is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Beatty Trantina helped with the phones. Thanks for listening, especially to Bonnie who called today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.